I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. I'm delighted to have all of our listeners here again. I'm also delighted to welcome my friend and colleague, Ambassador Kerry Kavanaugh, who works with me at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky, and we're going to talk about nuclear diplomacy. So, Kerry, how are you today?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day in Lexington, Kentucky.
All right. And it's a banner day for talking about nuclear diplomacy. So we are recording the day after President Trump had canceled or withdrawn U.S. participation from the JCPOA, and also this very same day that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in North Korea to discuss preparation for the nuclear summit. So I guess to start off with, since our readers don't know you, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and especially what experience you have with sort of the field of nuclear diplomacy?
I'm a professor of diplomacy and conflict resolution at the Patterson School of Diplomacy here at the University of Kentucky. But before that, I was a career foreign service officer. My focus was primarily Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and political military affairs and arms control. I covered some arms control in Washington, worked on the INF Treaty, worked on implementation of the INF Treaty, worked on the CFE Treaty in Europe, helped monitor Soviet withdrawal of forces from Europe at the end of the Cold War, also looked at nuclear weapons laboratories and defense cooperation on both sides following the collapse of the Soviet Union, in particular the implementation of the Nunn-Lugar Accord and measures we took to ensure security and safety of Soviet nuclear weapons as they repatriated to Russia from Ukraine and Kazakhstan.
So, I mean, just from that, I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest, I mean, you are probably one of the most knowledgeable people in America about this field of nuclear diplomacy and arms control diplomacy in terms of experience working with this.
I'm always reluctant to say most because there are many more who know more in depth about this, but my exposure, bad word to use when you talk about nuclear weapons, to nuclear weapons and arms control is significant. I've been to most of our national laboratories. I've seen our warheads, I've seen foreign nuclear systems, and because of my focus, which was a mediator, peace mediator for the United States, have also been around a lot of negotiations, so I have a fair amount of insight into what tends to work there, what becomes problematic there.
Right. So I guess to start off with, what does it, from your point of view, the sort of summit that people have talked about with respect to North Korea and the sort of goals that the administration has talked about it with respect to what it wants from the summit in North Korea, what kind of preparation normally goes into a summit of this magnitude? And from your point of view, how does sort of the current practice with what we're seeing right now depart from the norm of having this kind of conversation?
Certainly. It departs significantly in that the established practice is you don't bring leaders together until all the groundwork has really been laid and you have a very good sense of what can be accomplished at the end of the day and not. And what we see here is the opposite. It's not unknown. Reagan and Gorbachev at Reykjavik is probably the best example of here leaders want to meet. The intention was not to make significant progress on arms control, but to sort of test one another, gain a measure of each, and determine what might be done in a relationship. And in the wild and cold north of Iceland, without aides around, both of them start deciding maybe we need to do serious nuclear disarmament. Out of Reykjavik comes no agreement. But in fact, going into Reykjavik was very positive feelings of we should be able to cooperate. And those positive feelings and the relationship the leaders established set a framework that actually leads to substantial arms control, classic new forms of arms control with intense verification measures that eliminated the class of weapons in Europe. So we've seen in the past this can be successful. The difference with today, however, we aren't going into this, let's get a measure of each other and we're looking at how we might cooperate. We're going to this from a very hostile position. What is doable? We're sort of at the end. And the danger in setting up these negotiations this way is we've literally made it, if the president and Kim can't sit down and come to a solution, diplomacy has run its course. Normally in diplomacy, you never allow diplomacy to have run its course. We can always continue to talk. We can always continue to find paths forward. And the danger here is it that we'll get a great success? That would be wonderful. But if it doesn't go well, what can be done next?
Right. And I mean, to my recollection and to my knowledge, there is almost always some degree of moderating expectations from major events such as this. Right. There's never neither leader goes into it with an expectation of what will be achieved unless there has been considerable groundwork put together that effectively ensures that what the leader has predicted will happen. And there are still bad things that happen, but this is radically different than that.
Radically different.
Because, I mean, nobody seems to know what the result of these negotiations may be.
No, because the basic things that are normally discussed have never taken place here. The president got excited. Kim was talking about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. What does that mean? That was never fleshed out. If denuclearization means, and I think this is what President Trump believes, elimination of his weapons, elimination of his nuclear programs, shutdown of his nuclear reactors. President Trump's excited about that. But if denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula means elimination of all nuclear reactors on the Korean Peninsula, South Korea gets 20% of its energy from nuclear power. Who's going to pay for that? How is that going to happen? Does it mean no nuclear weapons can ever be introduced to the peninsula? How does that impact American naval fleets, where we have a neither confirm nor deny policy on whether any ship is carrying a nuclear armament? Would they no longer be allowed to dock in South Korea? Does that mean we would untangle our defense relationship with South Korea? And what concerns might that raise with Japan, nearby with similar watchful eyes on what's happening in North Korea? Diplomats in a normal circumstance would have sorted this all out ahead of time. And not only would we have sorted out the word, we would get a better fix on how many weapons are we talking about, what facilities are we talking about, if there would be an agreement, how would you verify it? It is not even clear at this point that the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna has sufficient inspectors to verify an agreement that could be reached if Kim is prepared to give up everything. Those are real challenges and valid diplomatic points that you've got to sort these details out. It's always said the devil is in the details. Here we're looking at an example where the details haven't even started to be looked at.
Right. I mean, we don't, and as you said, I mean, we, the South Koreans, the Chinese, and the North Koreans may all be approaching this with completely different definitions of what the word denuclearization means.
Exactly.
Right? And completely different senses of whether sort of we are approaching from a position of strength or a position of weakness. Now, and I suspect I know what you're going to say, right? Is there a danger with sort of this particular president, who is sort of not really well known for prepping heavily on sort of in terms of building up a lot of knowledge and reading a lot of stuff? I mean, how would people go about preparing President Trump to sit down with, I think it's Supreme Leader Kim, I'm not sure exactly what his title is. How would you go about prepping the president to be able to sit down and conduct the sort of negotiations that he seems to think that he wants to do, right? That seems like a really difficult job to me.
No, I think this is a real challenge in this case. And it isn't simply prepping him from a position where he's looked at these issues or focused on these issues for years or has a team around him who has done this. We have a president with a brand new Secretary of State Most of the Korean negotiating team that we had at the State Department has been pushed out or left. We had a nominee for Ambassador of South Korea. He withdrew because of a desire for the White House to potentially be even more aggressive. And the idea was, when there was a discussion of a bloody nose strike on North Korea, we could simply attack them. They wouldn't dare respond. Widespread view was they would, in fact, have no choice but to respond. So the president needs to get up to speed, but he doesn't really have a team around him who have looked at this in any depth. In fact, the deepest experienced person around him is brand new, his national security advisor, and his general approach on places like Korea and Iran are regime change and aggression.
Right, and I mean, when we're talking about, I mean, in terms of just sort of the straight leadership here, you know, whatever. I mean, Supreme Leader Kim is actually somewhat more experienced in this, strangely enough, than President Trump is, which is extremely unusual for what you would imagine Supreme Leader Kim. But the North Koreans have a reputation for being very professional diplomats.
No, they do.
An extremely professional diplomatic corps.
I mean, if you go back to Bismarck and Metternich's time, I think North Korea learned a lesson from history that you can leverage power with diplomacy. And they can be deft at it, not as cooperative as we would like, but they have been able to use it to their advantage. I suspect that will happen here. The other piece of preparation, there's both a learning component. You know, if in normal circumstance we would expect the president to be getting near constant briefings now, paper and oral, on here's what to face, here's what we need, intelligence briefings on here's the latest information we have. It's not clear any of that is happening. And the other piece that would normally be happening would be discussions with our partners. Interestingly, if we look to North Korea, Kim had never left the country before the approach of this summit. All of a sudden, he realized he needed to talk to the Chinese. He did. He needed to talk to South Koreans. He did. He went back to China for an unprecedented second visit. It's clear he is coordinating his approach, stances, and positions in anticipation of sitting down with President Trump and negotiating. We don't see signs of that coordination here. And in fact, as this momentum has been building for a summit on Korea, we've seen with the situation on the JCPOA the opposite, where all of a sudden we're withdrawing. We did discuss with the British and the Germans and the French our positions, but in fact they found out by watching television last minute, lot much detail as to what's next and how to deal with that. So on the diplomatic preparation side on Iran, we saw an absence of a truly coordinated effort, and I think there's a danger as we move into this talk on Korea, the same. There does seem to be some sentiment in Washington to dial back expectations a little. President had dropped hints that he thought the perfect place, perfect venue for talks might be the Peace House on the DMZ. I've been in that house. It is historic. It's interesting to be on that line of demarcation. And if you knew for sure you were concluding the Korean conflict or really able to initial a deal on nuclear weapons, you could even argue perfect. But if there's a chance this is going to go south and not be a smooth discussion, let alone a conclusive discussion, not a good venue for that. The dial back seems to be giving greater consideration to a more neutral location like Singapore, which could also invite then, if progress is made at some point, perhaps we go to the Peace House. But I think the initial thoughts on the Peace House were focused more on theatrics. Wouldn't that be great to see almost Hollywood staging of such an encounter? And not on the likelihood of the progress. I will say, when you know there's success, there are theatrics. These are big events when countries meet to resolve big problems like this. And this clearly is something President Trump would like to see happen, but whether the steps are in place to do it remain to be seen.
So, at the danger of delving too much into details that we just don't have an appreciation of, and especially of sort of what the North Korean intentions are, what some people have been saying for quite a since these offers happened was that the summit is essentially taking place sort of on a foundation that necessarily concedes major ground to North Korea, right? That a sets of demands that they have had with respect to being able to sit down with the United States and discuss these details. And of course, South Korea has been part of this, and we can talk a little bit about that too. That what we are potentially looking at here is a situation where North Korea is going to get to keep its nuclear weapons, but stop testing them, maybe. It's going to get to keep most of its ballistic missiles, and it's going to get sanctions relief, right? And that this is going to be sort of the peace that is achieved. That agreement, I think, would be considered a disaster from the perspective of nuclear nonproliferation, right? And the way that we have been thinking about nuclear nonproliferation, right? Essentially, we are welcoming North Korea back into the family of nations, despite the fact that it has sort of very few verifiable achievements with respect to its nuclear program.
No, indeed, it could be seen as rewarding them for the success they have had in developing nuclear weapons. And that is always the challenge in nonproliferation, is what do you do as a nation moves further down the path? Some people would argue North Korea has already won in these negotiations. If the negotiations don't achieve progress, North Korea is now far more visible as an acceptable player, far more engaged in a better way than Kim's father was with partners and neighbors. Is seen as willing to try to find a solution, and the United States has indeed given away things without concrete gains. It's positive we had the release of three Americans that were held captive this week to visiting Secretary of State Pompeo. We've had that kind of release in the past, so that itself is not unprecedented. But a sit-down meeting with the President of the United States before you can be sure really concessions are on the table, that is unprecedented. And it gives him enormous attention and an increased clout. There's often a concern in diplomacy, should you talk to enemies, should you talk to opponents, should you talk to terrorists? And the general diplomatic answer is, of course. If you rob a bank, the first thing, we've all seen these movies, that happens is the telephone rings and you're in that bank with the hostages and the police are asking, why are you doing this? What are you doing? And every police handbook in the nation would tell you that's standard operating procedure. That's like a diplomatic engagement. But we also know, because we've seen these movies, that's not always a friendly conversation. That can be a really harsh conversation. It may be, what are you doing and why? We want to know that. It may also be, no, I want you to be really calm and look down and you see the little red dots bouncing on your chest. That's where the bullets will enter your body if you don't do what's necessary. Diplomacy is infinitely malleable. We can send messages depending on the circumstance. We can do it in a different venue, at a different level, with a different finesse. That gets lost if you do instantly first encounter or almost first encounter is at the very top. And I think that's the challenge. Also, we have not seen in the past year shining examples of President Trump being able to diplomatically engage with partners and enemies on serious, deep, substantive issues like this with substantial success.
Right, that require a tremendous amount of detail. Let me sort of phrase my next question this way. Is there sort of a... phrasing it slightly different. 6 months ago, this situation had no apparent solution, right?
6 months ago, in fact, the tweets were about Little Rocket Man and fire and fury and test shots over Guam. No, it was a very different place, and it's not the standard setup to we should be meeting in a couple months and talk.
Well, but even, I mean, let's even push this back as far as the Obama administration, right? I mean, even then, sort of, this seemed like a very straitjacketed situation, right? And this goes, I mean, not just the Obama, all the way back into the Clinton, but certainly since North Korea tested nuclear weapons, this has seemed very straitjacketed, right? It's just, there was only one way to go here. It is North Korea slowly gaining more sophisticated nuclear weapons unless they collapse, right?
Well, let me say, not exactly, because there was an attitude. We could engage them diplomatically through six-party talks. Mm-hmm. We could give North Korea part of what they wanted, which was a more direct dialogue with the United States. And we did the edge of that. There was a reluctance to do that as fully as was necessary. And every once in a while, when we started to do that, we felt North Korea was taking advantage of us, and we would pull back. So there has been political reticence in the United States in engaging North Korea or Iran or Cuba in the manners that would have been necessary to really move some of those solutions forward. And I think that's a loss on our side. That's a mistake on our side, that we've been more inclined to use harsher measures, be it threat of military activity or economic sanctions, than engagement. We have had instances, and they're widely discussed, where we would send mediators to things like six-party talks or Assistant Secretary of State to a gathering in Asia where they were so politically tied in what they could do, they really didn't have the ability to engage diplomatically. I remember Assistant Secretary Kelly, our Assistant Secretary for East Asia and Pacific Affairs, at one point going to talks in China with the instructions from the White House, you're allowed to read this piece of paper and say nothing else, and any questions you were asked, refer them to the piece of paper. This isn't a constructive dialogue. This isn't how you build a trusting relationship. And, you know, we've made progress by getting China involved, getting Japan involved, getting Russia involved. South Korea involved. This is a complex constellation. You need to bring together, craft in the right way to make it work. And I don't think we can say at this point we gave that effort the full measure it needed to show success.
Right. And so, I mean, we have now, though, come to this situation where, you know, instead of saying, you know, the old hoary cliche, only Nixon could go to China, we now have only Trump could go to Pyongyang, right? And we have sort of this, one of the potential outcomes here is a North Korea that is normalized in something along the lines of same lines of Pakistan or India, right, where they sort of pursued their nuclear program, and they are returned in some fashion to the family of nations, right? And so there's no longer any need to take advantage of the United States in these kinds of agreements because they've won, right? They've eventually won what they were looking for. But this is also a situation where President Trump sort of can claim it as rhetorically can and will claim a victory for the United States in terms of freezing North Korea's nuclear and ballistic missile programs and then can bring that back, right? And so
perhaps, but his base has argued that North Korea has to abandon the nuclear weapons. And he continues to say that. So he is going into this on a premise that they will indeed give up everything, when the general expectation all around is they won't. And I think that's the inherent danger in not having laid the proper groundwork. And I would say on the diplomatic effort, and it's telling this week, while we didn't do that with Korea, we did end up doing that with Iran. We did craft through very detailed, lengthy, arduous diplomatic work, an agreement with Iran that really did block Iran's movement forward on nuclear weapons. Did it solve every problem we've ever had with Iran? Absolutely not. Was it ever expected to? Absolutely not. The challenge in Pyongyang right now is we're talking about a solution that solves every problem. oh, North Korea is going to be a totally different kind of state. They're going to give up all their nuclear weapons. They're going to give up all their nascent nuclear programs for energy, for science, for medicine. They're going to cooperate with us and not say we should reduce our forces in South Korea. We should change our security commitment. That's not very realistic when you look at what do we offer for all that. Remove sanctions, but only when it's all been done. I suspect that doesn't get us very far. The other piece that we need to always keep in mind, too, China does not see it in its interest to have a unified Korean Peninsula under American military dominance. We would say we're only there for defense. China's viewpoint on that is different. China sees that as an American intrusion into East Asia that should not be there. We have not expanded the number of troops there recently. That's good. But we have indeed upgraded air defense there, and including anti-ballistic missile systems that China is very upset about. So while
put on the table, right? I mean, those are...
They are. And yeah. I think that's smart. But it's important to realize Korea itself may not be able to set the agreement by itself, given its support that it requires from China for sustenance and China's concerns about what the United States is doing there. That second visit to Beijing may be very important in that regard. This may have been Kim talking to the Chinese, here's what I need and thinking of doing, and she saying to Kim, and here's the red lines for us.
Right, which we know from enough negotiation simulations. But let me sort of get back to this point where you were talking about Trump and his base. Let me suggest to you that President Trump, having accomplished an agreement, may not be fully frank and accurate with respect to his description of what that agreement entails to his base, right? And in a sense, I'm not sure that he is as constrained even by his own promises or by his base as a normal American president would be, or certainly than President Obama would have been, right? I mean, I think there's every reason to believe that he can come back with an agreement that we would objectively have claimed strongly favors North Korea's priors, strongly favors, and he will sell it as a victory, and his base will take it as a victory. This is one of his strengths, right?
And I think there's a great danger in that. I think we run the risk of agreements that aren't real or substantive, and the misunderstanding of what was said at the table or said in a side discussion without being able to factor in what's real. We mentioned earlier John Bolton has become National Security Advisor. Under George W. Bush, we had an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. It's interesting when you...
With Russia.
When you hear the litany of arms control agreements, this one's often left off. It's the SORT agreement. It's the Strategic Offensive Arms Reduction Treaty. And it was ratified by the Senate. But what it called for, and this arms control treaty is literally one page. And its provisions are so not detailed, and its verification not detailed, that indeed it became an agreement that didn't mean anything. The United States agreed we would reduce things this way. You had up to, you know, X amount of days to withdraw from the treaty, and you didn't have to do anything before the end of the treaty. To where literally it had no value. I hope we don't go there. That could become the worst of all possible things. A nominal agreement with no dates, no details, no verification provisions that let both sides say, yeah, it's going to happen. It never happens. And indeed, it leaves North Korea in this position of greater recognition, greater respect, the view of being more forthcoming in the region than they truly have been.
Well, I think that an even worse outcome might be something that we've talked about before, which is that, President Trump does not feel that he can come to any agreement with North Korea after sitting down, and that we return to this discussion of bloody noses which may be sort of, we tried diplomacy, diplomacy failed, even though we didn't really try it. But to finish up, We withdrew, or the United States is withdrawing from the JCPOA, and we don't know all the details of that, right? Much, the devil is all in the details, right? Your sense, I mean, a lot of people have said, well, why would North Korea ever go along with this if we pull out from the JCPOA? But, I mean, it seems to me North Korea must have priced this into their calculations. I mean, they cannot have been surprised.
I think they have, but I think it also means the price just went up again. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, while we have talked about not having the American military forces in South Korea on the table, they may be now. If you're talking about, you know, no real relaxation of sanctions till all these things are done, there may be a you start withdrawing troops before all these things are done. I fear we've raised questions about whether we are willing to abide by agreements we reach. And you can't function well as a nation if every political shift would call into question every previous agreement or treaty. It's simply not how the world works. It's not how business works. It's not how people work. You know, it's great. We're getting married. I love it. And next month I'll tell you if I still love it. Yes, we have provisions to withdraw from that. Very detailed legal provisions. This is much more consequential than that. We're talking potentially about war and peace. And we're certainly talking about millions of people's lives. So I think a lot's on the table when these two leaders get together later this month. And it's not at all clear what kind of outcome we'll get.
Well, is there anything else you wanted to add before we go?
I think that lays it out. I hope we have a good conclusion. I would love at the end of the day to be able to say this worked out in ways no one ever imagined. That could happen. As I said, Reykjavik happened that way. But this is coming at it very much cart before the horse.
Well, hopefully we can do this again after the summit to see exactly what more we know then from what happens then and what the new now looks like.
I'd be glad to do that.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And listeners, thank you as well. And we will have more of these in the future. So thank you again.